The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with a look at some recent stories on our daily news site. Well, first, Dave, finally an explanation for a very old observation about trees.
Right. Well, Stuart, this observation actually comes from Leonardo da Vinci, who a few hundred years ago, he observed that a tree's trunk almost always grows so that the total thickness of the branches at a particular height is equal to the thickness of the trunk. So in other words, if the trunk splits into two branches, if you take the cross-section of those two branches and add the diameters together, you're going to get the same diameter as you would the trunk. If those two branches split into more branches and you add all those branches all together, the cross-section of all those added together will also equal the trunk, and so on and so forth.
So kind of a fractal pattern.
Exactly.
Here.
So this was an interesting observation, but for the longest time, researchers couldn't figure out why trees followed this seemingly very strict mathematical rule. And one theory was maybe it was most efficient for the tree to pump water if it followed this pattern, but nobody was really sure.
And so now some people have put together a different model?
Exactly. Or? So this new model comes at it from sort of a different angle. And the researcher here sort of imagined a tree as a series of cantilevered beams, the beams sort of being the branches. And as you said earlier, he incorporated this idea of fractals as well, the idea that, you know, something gets split into parts and becomes smaller and smaller and smaller through infinity. And he plugged all this stuff into a computer simulation. And what he found was that what made the most sense, the reason that trees seem to follow this rule, is because following this rule helps them resist wind breakage. If trees don't follow this rule, the branches can splinter, the tree can actually fall down. A lot of bad things happen. And for some reason, when trees obey this precise mathematical rule, that doesn't happen.
And so Leonardo's formula just kind of falls out of this model?
Exactly, exactly. It's a really good fit, actually.
Are there any applications beyond just the interest of this showing the reason for that?
Well, researchers say that it could actually help them model storm damage. In the recent Hurricane Irene in the U.S., a lot of trees fell down. In fact, even one in my neighborhood fell down and crushed a few cars. And researchers say that by knowing exactly what sort of wind forces can affect trees and how they can affect trees, it could really help our understanding of wind-based damage.
And next, something on how worms make sure that their diets are healthy.
Right, Stuart. Well, this story is about how worms learn. And it's not maybe the kind of worm you're thinking of. These are actually really tiny worms. They're known as C. elegans, and they're a very popular model for laboratory study. These worms are just about a millimeter long, so they're pretty much microscopic. And the worms tend to eat everything in their path. But some worms are pickier than others, which suggested to researchers that these worms, even though they only have a handful of neurons compared to our hundreds of millions or perhaps billions of neurons, that they have a way of learning. And this new study is all about trying to figure out how these C. elegans worms learn.
And so how do you determine something like that?
Well, what the researchers did was they took a variety of strains of C. elegans and they plated them on a plastic dish. And this dish also had some kind of nasty bacteria known as Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And these bacteria not only make worms sick, they actually make us sick as well. And what the researchers found is that most of the strains, when they put them on this plate with the bacteria, the worms would sort of go up to the bacteria, maybe take a little bite, and then just quickly move away. But there was one strain of worms that just kept on eating. And so these worms were kind of like the slow worms of the group. They really didn't seem to be learning that they shouldn't be eating these bacteria. They just kept on eating and they actually kept on dying. And the researchers wanted to figure out, well, what's the difference between the worms that are learning and the worms that aren't learning?
And so what makes a good self-educating worm?
Right. Well, it turns out it's a gene called HECW1. And this is a gene that's involved in the worm's nervous system. And it also seems to be expressed in its sensory neurons, which would make sense if it's involved in learning and perhaps interacting with the environment and things like that. What they found was that the worms that were sort of slower on the uptake had mutations in this gene, and that may explain why these worms just kept on eating when they really shouldn't have and really weren't learning from their mistakes.
I suppose, though, that there's such a thing as being too picky.
Right. And so the whole question here is, why did this one strain of C. elegans evolve this slow learning ability in the first place? And it could be it doesn't encounter toxic bacteria like Pseudomonas in its environment. And you can imagine it's not really a good idea for a worm to be picky unless it really has to. If you're really picky, you're really going to limit your food options. But if you don't have to be picky, like this one strain doesn't have to be, then it's kind of nice to be an omnivore. And so there is a reason for some worms being slower learners and some worms being faster learners.
What about organisms bigger than worms?
Right. Well, it's a good question. And a lot of people ask, you know, why are scientists studying these tiny microscopic worms? What on earth could that tell us about ourselves? But in fact, because worms have so few neurons, they actually only have about 300 neurons, and we have 300 million times that, they're a very simple system to study these sorts of things. And if we can figure out the genetic basis of behavior in a worm, it could shed a little bit of light about what's happening in our own brains.
And finally, the news that I, at least, have been waiting for most of my life, looks like a tractor beam might actually be possible.
Right, Stuart. This last story is about new progress towards developing a real-life tractor beam. And this is actually a story that deals with four groups of physicists, all who have independently come up with an idea for a tractor beam that would actually work. And when we say tractor beam, for those that don't know, we're talking about...
Those that don't know.
Right. There are a few of them out there that haven't seen Star Trek or Star Wars. But basically, a tractor beam is, you know, ostensibly this beam of light that would lock onto an object and pull that object in, kind of like a tow truck with light. It's an interesting concept, but obviously very tricky to pull off. Although scientists have made some progress toward this. In the past few decades, they've used light to push objects. Believe it or not, light, even though it doesn't seem like it's able to do this, can actually generate force. It's like the world's tiniest blast from a water hose.
I can understand that light would have some force associated with it, all those little photons pushing against something, if you will, but I'm having a little trouble envisioning how it might pull an
object. Right, exactly. It's one thing to push, and it's another thing to pull. And what this new research involves is tweaking the light, and in this case, it's a laser beam, tweaking it so that it actually adopts a pulling force. And what you basically have is in an ordinary beam of light, as you said, Stuart, each photon moves in the direction of the beam. But what these researchers proposed is creating overlapping light waves that would make an angle relative to the desired direction that you want these objects to move. And these overlapping waves would produce a forward-moving beam, which is known as the Bessel beam. But in this beam, each photon is actually moving at an angle relative to the beam, so that when one of these photons bounces off an object, it exerts a small forward push. Now, we're still having push here. And where the pull comes in is the researchers can actually tweak the properties of the object so that it actually becomes polarized by the light. The object changes electrically and magnetically, and the polarized object will then radiate and redirect the light. And by adjusting the material properties of the objects and the polarizations and the synchronization of the individual light waves of the beam, physicists can make the object radiate more light forward along the beam than backward towards its source. Now, this all sounds very complicated.
So they create a little, but it's like creating a little retro rocket, actually.
Exactly. It's like creating a reverse thruster. You can actually see sort of a diagram of what this would look like on the website.
Well, I guess one thing that's interesting here is that you have four separate labs converging on the same idea.
Exactly. And they all have various little tweaks on the idea, and some of their ideas work better for certain types of objects, and some work better for other types of objects. And you can actually look at the story on the site to get a sense for how all these groups differ. But it's the same basic idea.
Well, how big of an object are we actually talking about pulling here?
Well, unfortunately, Stuart, your dreams of seeing something pulled through space may not actually materialize anytime soon. We're not talking about something as big as the Millennium Falcon or the Starship Enterprise. Right now, this would probably work with something about the size of a grain of salt.
Oh.
So you're going to have to wait.
Breaking my heart.
I know. You're going to have to wait a little bit longer for a bigger object to be pulled around by light.
Okay, Dave, so what else are you looking at for the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story on synesthesia. This is this interesting neurological disorder where some people see a number, but they also see a color associated with that number that other people don't see. Also, a story about reconstructing a 47-million-year-old moth, trying to figure out exactly what it looked like and what colors it sported. For Science Insider, we've got a lot of stories this week about the 2012 U.S. budget. What's going to happen with agencies like the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and other agencies, and how their budgets will impact science in the U.S. and elsewhere. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Alive is about the science of storm chasing. We'll have a couple guests on. We'll talk about what it's like to fly a retrofitted warplane into the heart of a storm. So be sure to check out all of these items on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.